Welcome to Hepatocellular Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Anthony Alquieri, and to begin, he provided a macro view of the field.
This is an exciting time in the treatment of HCC, of hepatocellular carcinoma. As everyone recalls, about 10 years ago, we had the approval of sorafenib as the first FDA-approved systemic therapy for advanced HCC. Then for a long time, we had a big gap of about 10 years with no other approvals. There were multiple failed phase 3 studies, some in the first line comparing multiple agents to sorafenib, and some in the second line comparing agents to best supportive care. Unfortunately, all of these were negative. Finally, over the past 2 years, there's been some light at the end of the tunnel. There's now promising data or positive data with regorafenib in second line, post-sorafenib, showing a survival benefit. We have the exciting data that's emerging from the phase 1-2 study with nivolumab, again, utilizing immunotherapy for hepatocellular carcinoma. We've heard about a press release with lenvatinib compared in first line to sorafenib, and the press release told us that the study met its primary endpoint of non-inferiority in overall survival to sorafenib. So certainly we're seeing some more positive data recently. The other exciting thing is that the research has broadened in scope. So for a long time, the focus was always on targeted therapies. And whereas targeted therapies do have a place in hepatocellular carcinoma, this is such a complex and heterogeneous disease that targeting the immune system, targeting the stroma, targeting the epigenome, targeting stem cells, tumor-initiating cells, all these things will probably have a role in complementing existing therapies in this disease. So it's a very exciting time.
So I want to go through your cases, but one thing I wanted to ask you about, because we collected a bunch of questions that were sent in by general oncologists. And one thing I thought was an interesting question, maybe you can comment a little bit on, is, well, first of all, the overall global sort of epidemiology of HCC today in terms of, you know, pre-existing conditions, Hep B, C, NASH, et cetera, and how these affect the medical oncologic management of these patients with advanced disease.
Certainly. So as far as epidemiology, the striking observation that's been now reported in more than one publication is the consistent rise in the incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma over the past two decades. And this data is specifically from the United States, where there is consistent increase. Initially, there were many hypotheses relaying this increase to hepatitis C. People who are infected to hepatitis C, this is the time that they're actually developing cirrhosis and coming up with the hepatocellular carcinoma. However, there may be other factors, you know, the obesity epidemic, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, all of these now have been associated with HCC as well, some through NASH, some maybe indirectly in other ways. So the first point I'd like to make is the rising incidence. The second issue, we all know about the new approvals of multiple therapies for hepatitis C treatment. Most of us believe that the eradication of hepatitis C will not show an impact on the incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma and on the medical treatment of patients with hepatocellular carcinoma for a few decades down the road. So this is not changing the current situation. Now, there's a bit of controversy as to whether treating the hepatitis C in patients with established cirrhosis may expedite or indirectly cause the onset or the appearance of hepatocellular carcinoma. So there are some contradictory reports that have come out that potentially the treatment of hepatitis C may accelerate tumor development. So this area now is an area of active investigation. There's quite a bit of controversy, and it is unclear whether treating the hepatitis C, at least in the setting of existing cancer, is even important or whether it makes any difference.
Any pathophysiologic explanation?
It is unclear at this point. One of the hypotheses that has been thrown around is that by shutting down the virus, we may be curtailing a certain immune response that may have been keeping the tumors in check, or the pre-malignant state in check. But this is really an area that warrants a lot more investigation. I guess my only comment here is that we should not be rushing to treat the hepatitis C in patients who have early hepatocellular carcinoma, because there's no evidence that it would change their survival. And there's some concern that it may affect the tumor behavior at this point.
You know, you hear about intrinsic tumor subtypes in breast cancer, I've heard about in colon cancer and other cancers. What do we know about intrinsic subtypes or genomic variation with HCC? And does the Hep C, Hep B, other, are they different phenotypically, genomically?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's an area with a lot of emerging data now. We know from some publications that, for example, there is an inflammatory subtype of HCC. There is more an proliferative subtype where the, you know, the TKIs may be the best fit. Again, hypothetically speaking, there is a third category that's more stem cell-like. It's Wnt driven with a lot of mutations in the Wnt pathway, especially in beta catenin. And we have not gotten to the point where these molecular subtypes have been treated differently yet, or we're not selecting patients based on these categories yet. But I think as more therapies become available, I think we're going to see more effort at treating these different molecular subtypes maybe potentially differently, as they may benefit differently from different therapies. As far as your question regarding etiology, there's actually a lot of data showing differences in oncogenic pathways that are upregulated in hepatitis C versus hepatitis B, in microRNA profile, in gene expression profile. So at the molecular biologic level, the oncogenesis is different when driven by hepatitis B versus C. With that said, that doesn't mean that they're going to respond differently to all the therapies. They may respond similarly to certain therapies, but differently to others. So you will see some of the more recent clinical trials are stratifying by etiology and attempting to tease that out.
You know, as long as we are kind of talking a little bit about the biology, I know we want to discuss, of course, checkpoint inhibitors, but as long as you're talking about this, can you talk a little bit about sort of biologically or immunologically why, you know, HCC might or might not respond to immune therapy, specifically checkpoint inhibitors? You know, one of the things you hear across different tumors is mutational load. You think about HCC, I would have thought there was a high mutational load, but anyhow, I understand there isn't. You tell me, why do you think they respond?
So the short answer is we do not know. There are many theories as to why HCC may be responding. We know that in the setting of hepatocellular carcinoma, there are many immunosuppressive mechanisms that are turned on, right? There is an increase in immunosuppressive cytokines. There is an increase in myeloid-derived suppressor cells, for example, which counteract the anti-tumor immunity. There is upregulation of PD-1, PD-L1, PD-L2. There is an upregulation of Tregs, T-regulatory lymphocytes, which are not the ones that will achieve anti-tumor immunity. So we know that the tumor itself and potentially the host are revving up these immunosuppressive mechanisms. And this is why potentially using checkpoint inhibition to relieve some of this immunosuppression may be effective in this disease. The other thing is that this is thought to be an inflammatory tumor, right? Most of the time it arises in the setting of an inflammatory etiology, whether it's viral hepatitis, autoimmune hepatitis, etc. So there is an inflammatory background, which again may be conducive to immunotherapy.
Before we get to that, maybe we can talk a little bit about TKIs and anti-VEGF therapy in HCC. If you could kind of maybe go through a little bit in terms of where we started in terms of sorafenib, what we learned in terms of regorafenib, and then I'm really curious to hear about this lenvatinib trial.
Okay. So I mean, with sorafenib, there were two international trials that established this as the standard first-line systemic therapy for advanced hepatocellular carcinoma. And just to make sure that we're speaking the same language, when we say advanced hepatocellular carcinoma, we're talking really about patients who generally have either extrahepatic metastases or have liver-limited disease with vascular invasion, traditionally portal vein invasion. This is macroscopic, so visible on a scan. Or patients who have liver-limited disease and have failed locoregional modalities, so they have progressed post-transarterial chemoembolization. So if you use the Barcelona Clinic Liver Cancer Staging System, these are patients with BCLC stage C or B who have progressed on locoregional therapy. That's the traditional population. So both the SHARP trial and the Asia-Pacific trial showed a statistically and clinically significant improvement in overall survival with sorafenib compared to placebo, with a hazard ratio in the range of 0.6, so about a 40% risk reduction for death. So this was consistent data across two trials and established sorafenib as the standard of care. Now, of note, most of us who've treated this disease realize that the chance of a radiologic response with sorafenib is quite minimal. We're talking about 2 to 3% range. But nonetheless, there is a cytostatic effect and improvement in survival. Then I mentioned earlier the multiple failed trials until we got to regorafenib, which is really very similar in sorafenib as far as the targets, but it's a bit more broad. So there are certain targets of regorafenib that are not clearly targets of sorafenib. For example, FGFR, TIE2, TIE2. And the pharmacokinetics of regorafenib, of the byproducts of regorafenib, are different than sorafenib. So nonetheless, so the regorafenib resource trial evaluated regorafenib in patients who had confirmed radiologic progression on sorafenib. And they were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion against best supportive care and placebo. Patients must have tolerated sorafenib for 20 out of the last 28 days of therapy, and they must have tolerated a minimum dose of 400 milligrams daily. So it was a select patient population in that sense. The regorafenib trial, the resource trial, showed a statistically significant improvement in survival. So we're talking about a median survival in the 10 to 11 month range compared to 7 to 8 months with placebo in second line therapy. The other important observation from the resource trial is the fact that we were able to treat patients with hepatocellular carcinoma with regorafenib. 50% of the patients actually were able to tolerate a full dose. About 50% had dose interruptions and reductions. So this was an important observation.
And this was 160 milligrams?
160, yeah.
That's interesting.
Now, it's important again to remember that these were patients with Chalp-UA cirrhosis. These did not have decompensated cirrhosis. And they are patients, again, who had established sorafenib tolerability. That was part of the inclusion criteria. And then you asked me about the lenvatinib, and we actually don't know very much except for what was released in the press release. This was a randomized phase 3 trial of lenvatinib versus sorafenib in first-line therapy. It was designed as a non-inferiority study with a primary endpoint of overall survival, and we are told that it met its primary endpoint. We are also told that there were some signs of superiority or improvement in some of the secondary endpoints, including response rate and time to progression. This, we're told, also will be presented soon, so I'm assuming at ASCO 2017 we'll be hearing about this phase 3 trial.
So, I don't know, it seems kind of strange that they would do a non-inferiority trial. What was the thinking?
You know, probably multiple considerations go into these decisions.
Is it significantly less toxic?
From what we know about the drug, the toxicity profiles do overlap between the two drugs, except that there seems to be, based at least on the press release and some of the data in other tumor types, the skin toxicity may be a bit less with lenvatinib. We'll see if that pans out when we hear all the data.
Have you yourself used lenvatinib in any patients with HCC?
No, I have not. There was a previous phase 2 trial done in this population, which was about 46 patients, and we had not participated in that study.
Interesting. Getting back to regorafenib, Have you adapted that to your practice? Are you using it second line?
Yeah, so as you know, we're still pending FDA approval, but we have certainly used it in select patients in second line. And we've tried to follow the eligibility that were in the study since we're still learning to use it in patients with HCC. So these are patients who had progressed on sorafenib, who had tolerated sorafenib reasonably well, and had definitive radiologic progression. And yes, we've tried it. And I would say our experience, although small at this point, has mirrored what was reported in the publication, that about 50% of patients were able to tolerate the full dose and another 50% required interruptions or reductions.
Globally, when you think back on your clinical experience with sorafenib, you know, in general, what fraction of patients do you think actually benefit from the drug that you can afterwards go, you know, I think that patient benefited?
Well, I would say, again, with sorafenib, the challenge is we don't see tumor reduction radiologically. And we're relying on the stabilization of disease. But I can tell you certainly that in the 30 to 40% of patients who actually present with symptomatic disease, let's say pain, fatigue, etc., I certainly see about 30 to 40% who tell us that they've had an improvement in symptoms. So that's a good practical measure of benefit. If you look at the publications, I mean, the disease stabilization rate is as high as 60, 70% with sorafenib. And we certainly do see that. And one of the keys with these TKIs, such as sorafenib, is to also not quit too early. I mean, these are patients that you put on treatment. The first scan may show minor changes, minor increase in some tumors. But what's not reported frequently on radiology reports is the fact that the tumor potentially could be becoming less enhancing, less active. There's some necrosis. So if we're looking superficially at radiology reports and only looking at size, we may be fooled and quit early. The other thing that could happen in the liver, you could have appearance of small, nonspecific, arterially enhancing lesions, you know, a centimeter here or there, and these may not be very meaningful. So one of the keys to seeing the benefit of sorafenib is to maintain the therapy until there is definitive radiologic and or clinical progression.
Globally, what fraction of patients do you think benefit from second-line regorafenib?
Okay, so the regorafenib benefit, again, is slightly narrower because by selection criteria for the clinical trial, the patients had to have tolerated sorafenib. They had to have had definitive radiologic progression. If you look at the publication, the median time on sorafenib for these patients was 7 to 8 months. So these were patients who actually had done well on sorafenib and had tolerated it. And they're the ones who went onto the study. So I think the population that benefits from regorafenib based on that reported trial is narrower. And I think right now I encourage my colleagues to stick to the eligibility that was reported in the trial because that's where we're more likely to see the benefit before we start expanding the usage.
So, you know, it's been interesting to trace what's happened in terms of dosing of regorafenib in colorectal cancer. We work with your colleague Heinz Lenz a lot. And there, they often, of course, those patients haven't had a prior TKI. And there, now a lot of people, you know, reduce the dose preemptively to 120, even to 80. Again, on these patients who have tolerated sorafenib globally, it sounds like a number of these patients actually can tolerate full dose. When you do see toxicity, what do you see?
If we talk about the higher grade toxicities, you know, grade 3 and 4, the most common ones were expected: hypertension, diarrhea, fatigue. I would say these were the top three probably. Interestingly enough, as far as high grade, there was no difference in hepatobiliary events, elevation of liver enzymes, bilirubin, ascites. It was actually quite similar, if anything, slightly more frequent overall in the placebo group than in the regorafenib group. The skin toxicity was actually not very high and was quite minimal and low grade. So it is interesting that if I do a cross-trial comparison between colon and HCC, the tolerability is different. And some hypotheses have to do with the fact that colon cancer patients have received multiple cytotoxic regimens before they get to regorafenib versus the HCC patients who are getting this as second line and they've already proven that they can tolerate the sister drug, sorafenib. So that could be the difference.
That's very interesting. What about the trials looking at regorafenib first line against sorafenib?
So I'm not aware of any trials comparing regorafenib to sorafenib head-to-head in first line. And at this point, we actually do not have first line regorafenib data. I think there are potential trials in discussion combining regorafenib with other compounds, including immunotherapy potentially. Those I'm aware of.
So let's talk about checkpoint inhibitors and the data that's come out looking at them. You've been very involved with that. Can you kind of go through that?
Sure. So the trial that I've been involved in is the phase 1-2 study evaluating nivolumab, the anti-PD-1 monoclonal antibody in patients with advanced HCC. This was a phase 1 trial initially, so there was a dose escalation. And the dose escalation was carefully done in parallel groups. So there was a group of patients infected with hepatitis B, a group with hepatitis C, and a group of uninfected patients. And the reason is because we had no safety data of treating patients who have a viral infection with these checkpoint inhibitors. The summary is that the tolerability profile during the dose escalation of nivolumab was similar to that of nivolumab in other tumor types. Escalation up to the standard dose of 3 milligrams per kilogram, there were actually no dose-limiting toxicities in any of the groups. The only dose-limiting toxicity was in a patient who was uninfected at the 10 milligram per kilogram dose, who had liver decompensation and soon after was found to have actually progressive disease. So from a safety perspective, the dose escalation showed good tolerability. The phase 1 was followed by 4 parallel expansions of 50 patients each. 50 patients who are uninfected and sorafenib naive, 50 patients who are uninfected and sorafenib progressors, 50 patients with hepatitis C, and 50 patients with hepatitis B. So the total population now is, if you look at both the escalation and expansion, is around 250 patients, which is a great large experience. The manuscript was actually submitted now for this experience, and we're seeing an overall response rate, objective response rate, using RECIST 1.1 of 20%. And the responses seem to happen across all etiologies, whether it's hepatitis B, C, or uninfected. They also seem to happen independent of whether the patients had prior sorafenib or not. So that's important to notice as well. The follow-up is not mature for all the patient categories. From the dose escalation part of the study, which is about, you know, mid-40s, 45 patients or so, 48 patients, the median survival for the patients who were sorafenib exposed already was about 15 months. The median survival for the patients who are sorafenib naive was about 14 months. Overall, the median overall survival for patients who were sorafenib exposed for the overall population was about 13 months. We're waiting for the survival data to mature for the different subgroups at this point. But in short, that is an important signal as far as response rate, and that is a promising signal as far as overall survival.
What about the issue, and this comes up in many other cancers, of duration of treatment, patients having prolonged progression-free survivals? You know, there's been a lot of discussion about whether even we're looking at the right endpoints. But I don't know, maybe you could pick maybe 2 years, for example. I don't even know if there's enough experience at this point. But do you have any feel for what fraction of patients have survival that's just completely beyond what you would expect? And is this mainly responders?
Well, these are great questions. Some things to help maybe clarify and address your question. The median duration of response in the dose escalation phase, which again, where we have longer follow-up, was 17 months. So these are very deep, durable responses. Among the responders actually were 3 complete responses in the dose escalation phase. In the patients who have stable disease, we see a range of stability lasting as long as 17, 18 months. So I think the benefit seems to be from both the responders as well as the patients who have stable disease that is quite durable. As far as a percentage of patients who are alive, or you know, the survival rate at certain specific timelines, let's say at 9 months, etc. For the overall population, again, the 200 and some patients, the 9-month survival rate was actually around 70%, which is again, comparing to other historical data, quite promising. And again, one of the tricks with immunotherapy to mention here, like all immunotherapy studies, we allow for this phenomenon that's referred to as pseudoprogression. So we don't abandon the therapy at the first sign of progression. So the patient's doing well clinically. There is some radiologic progression. We definitely kept these patients on therapy. Many of them actually subsequently stabilized, and a minority had some degree of response subsequently as well.
That's certainly a theme we hear throughout oncology. What do we know about PD-1 levels, first of all, in HCC in general, but also in relationship to treatment benefit with HCC?
Yeah. So previous reports, which again were small reports, reported a broad range of PD-1 and PD-L1 expression. I mean, anywhere from 20 to 60%. In our clinical trial, this data is still coming together. But the PD-1 positivity rate on tumor cells, just to be specific, because you can look at PD-1 and PD-L1 on different cellular subtypes. I'm talking about PD-1 expression on the tumor cells themselves was actually in the range of 20%. And the responses occurred independent of PD-1 expression. We saw objective responses in the PD-1 negative as well as the PD-1 positive patients. So in the limited experience so far, looking at PD-1 expression on tumor cells, it does not seem to be a predictive marker at this point.
What data do we have on other checkpoint inhibitors beyond nivolumab and HCC?
So there have been small reports with pembrolizumab, another PD-1 inhibitor, a PD-1 antibody, with durvalumab, which targets PD-L1. There is a second-line randomized phase 3 study of pembrolizumab versus best supportive care that is ongoing and accruing. And there's an ongoing, I believe, phase 1 or phase 1-2 study with durvalumab, as well as durvalumab in combination with tremelimumab, so a combination of PD-L1 and CTLA-4 inhibition. These are ongoing at this point.
So based on the available clinical data, right now, sort of putting aside FDA, cost, reimbursement, based on these data, how do you think checkpoint inhibitors, and it seems like nivolumab there's a lot more experience with, should be integrated into non-protocol management?
Well, I think what we know about nivolumab specifically and checkpoints, the striking tolerability in HCC is important. This is a tough disease, as we all know. There's concurrent cirrhosis, liver dysfunction, etc. So the safety profile is certainly favorable. And again, the early signals of efficacy are promising. As far as off-label usage, it may be used. The majority of the data right now is in patients who are post-sorafenib, I would say, from the initial phase 1-2 study. But there's certainly a group of patients who were sorafenib naive as well. So, you know, it'd be hard for me to extrapolate from that and make practice recommendations. But, you know, the data is there. It's promising. The randomized phase 3 study of nivolumab versus sorafenib also should be reading out in the coming year or year and a half, probably. So we will have more data coming.
But I mean, for practical purposes, in your own clinical practice, if you have a patient who's not eligible for a trial, Do you attempt to integrate any of the checkpoint inhibitors into their management? And have you been able to even get it paid for?
Sure. Yes, I have occasionally. It's been mostly in the second or sometimes third line setting where we've done that. As far as the ability to get reimbursement, it's been, I would say, 50%. There are many patient assistance programs with many of the pharmaceutical industry sponsors who have these compounds as well. So I think the ability to access these agents for patients is there. It's available.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just based on the data that you described, and I mean, looking at sorafenib, which is, you know, certainly very, very suboptimal therapy, to me, it seems like, I mean, I think if I were in that situation, I might want to get a first line.
And that's happening, of course, both on trial and off trial. It is happening. I'm aware of that happening. The challenge we have is how do you select patients? And we right now do not have the tools. Is this a patient who would benefit from sorafenib, or is this a patient that's going to have a deep response with nivolumab in first-line therapy? And right now, it's a guess.
You know, we hear a lot of excitement from the renal investigators about combining VEGF TKIs with checkpoint inhibitors. You know, Bob Motzer, he's very, very excited about that. What about that strategy in HCC?
It's starting, it's emerging. There are many clinical trials in planning phases, combining PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors with different TKIs. I mean, some with sorafenib, regorafenib, but some with other TKIs, including some of the other TKIs that have been evaluated in HCC, lenvatinib, cabozantinib, etc. So these are in the planning phases at this point.
I also wonder about, you know, you hear about the abscopal effect of radiation therapy with checkpoint inhibitors, at least theoretically you hear that discussed. And, you know, in HCC, there's a lot of liver-directed, what I would call radiation-type treatment, particularly with spheres. Again, any interest in that strategy?
Absolutely, absolutely. So some of these trials have started. So at the NCI, the group led by Tim Grattan is evaluating tremelimumab, so an anti-CTLA-4 antibody, with TACE or radiofrequency ablation. And we've had some early reports from that study showing the feasibility of this approach and some proof of concept findings as far as recruitment of immune cells to the tumor, etc. So it's certainly a potentially promising approach. There's certainly strong rationale that the locoregional therapy may increase neoantigen exposure, etc. And I'm aware of other trials that are in planning stages as well.
You mentioned tremelimumab. What do we know in general about anti-CTLA-4 agents in HCC and also the combination of PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4?
So tremelimumab actually was the first checkpoint inhibitor to be evaluated in HCC as a single agent. There's a study from Bruno Sangro from Spain that was published in the Journal of Hepatology, a small study, phase 2 study with tremelimumab as a single agent where he had a response rate of about 18%. He included patients with both Child-Pugh A and B, certainly an advanced population, and had an overall survival of 8 months. But at least, you know, they showed the feasibility of evaluating a checkpoint inhibitor in that setting. They had more AST and ALT elevations with tremelimumab at the dose used in that study and in those patients. So I'm not aware of tremelimumab being evaluated currently as a single agent anymore, but certainly in combination with durvalumab that's ongoing. As part of the CheckMate 040 trial, which is the phase 1-2 of nivolumab that we've been talking about, there's now been a cohort of the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab that's completed accrual as well. And we evaluated different doses of ipilimumab. We're still waiting for the safety readout as well as the efficacy readout on that part as well.
And of course, that's a big question in a number of other cancers. Any guesses about what we're going to see other than more toxicity?
I think the toxicity will be dose dependent from what we're learning in other tumor types and from my anecdotal experience so far. So it'll depend on the ipilimumab dose that's used. The challenge, though, is that the increased efficacy may be linked to the dose of ipilimumab. That's if you're asking me to guess. So we will see.
Speaking of toxicity, you do see, you know, LFT elevations, hepatic toxicity with checkpoint inhibitors. Do you see this with HCC, and how much of a problem is it?
It's a great question again. So the grade 3 and 4 AST-ALT elevations with nivolumab were actually in the range of 3 to 4%. If you look at all grade elevations, most of the AST-ALT elevations were transient and were self-limited. In the dose escalation part of the study, many of the patients who had elevations, even without initiation of steroid therapy, many of them, actually, the liver enzymes came back down on their own, and the liver enzyme elevations were not accompanied by signs of liver decompensation. They were not in conjunction with bilirubin elevation or new onset ascites. So as far as liver toxicity, it is no different than seen in other tumor types.
So I'd like to go through your cases. I want to start out with your 74-year-old man with chronic hepatitis, no evidence of portal hypertension or cirrhosis, who presented with a single 5-point centimeter lesion. Can you talk about what happened?
So this is, again, a patient, as you summarized, with a single lesion and no overt cirrhosis and no portal hypertension. And interesting that the etiology here is hepatitis B, where we know this is one etiology that could result in the development of hepatocellular carcinoma without necessarily having developed cirrhosis. And because this was a solitary lesion because it was in the setting of absence of portal hypertension and liver cirrhosis. This was a great candidate for liver resection. So the patient underwent surgical resection. And again, we found a single mass, 6.5 centimeters, with moderately differentiated hepatocellular carcinoma with microscopic vascular invasion on histology. The margins were negative. And then subsequently, the patient was placed on surveillance and now is alive 4 years later with no disease recurrence. I think one of the things that I wanted to highlight here is that many oncologists would be concerned. This is a tumor that's above 5 centimeters in size that has microscopic vascular invasion. These are high-risk features for a resection. But nonetheless, we did not give any adjuvant treatment because currently there is no standard adjuvant therapy. As we know, the STORM trial, which evaluated sorafenib post-resection or post-RFA, was negative. So we currently do not have standard adjuvant therapies, and surveillance is what's indicated.
Just out of curiosity, what would you or what did you estimate his risk of recurrence after surgery when you evaluated him? If you had to come up with a number, what do you think it would be?
It's somewhere between 50 and probably 60%.
And are there any situations, you know, in patients even at higher risk therapy that you would consider adjuvant therapy, sorafenib? Are there any adjuvant trials? Are there any adjuvant checkpoint trials?
Adjuvant checkpoint trials are being discussed.
I guess there are not that many patients in this situation a year. Is that true?
Or how worldwide, there's a large patient population because resection is very commonly used in Asia.
Huh.
And in Asia, the pattern of resection is quite a bit more liberal than is done in the United States. But also resection is, I think, gaining momentum as well in larger centers that have multidisciplinary teams in the United States as well. So it is a big patient population. There is an unmet need there. But to answer your question, no, despite high-risk features, there's really no data to support any adjuvant treatment at this point.
So this patient seems like he really fits a perfect criteria for resection. How would you describe a perfect scenario for transplant?
So the benefit of transplant is treating two problems at once, right? The underlying liver cirrhosis and decompensation, as well as the tumor burden. So patients who are within the Milan criteria, right? One solitary tumor below 5 centimeters or up to 3 tumors, with the largest one being 3 centimeters or less, and have liver dysfunction, right? These are patients who have usually portal hypertension, maybe Chalpiubi cirrhosis, elevated bilirubin, low platelets. So they have things that would be at least relative contraindications to resection. These are the patients who are directed more towards liver transplant and are the ideal candidates. Now, we now have enough experience, both in the US and worldwide, that there is a group of patients who are beyond the Milan criteria that can be downstaged. And if they are downstaged appropriately, they can do quite well with liver transplant. Now, there are different criteria that are used. In the United States, most commonly we refer to them as the UCSF criteria, the expanded criteria. But if these patients, again, can be downstaged with local regional therapy, such as chemoembolization, Y90, et cetera, and can come down within Milan criteria and stay there, they tend to do well. There are some high-risk features that are concerning for these patients and makes it unlikely that we'll downstage appropriately. If they have an elevated alpha-fetoprotein above 1,000, if they don't respond well to chemoembolization, these are ominous signs that the prognosis is not great and it's unlikely that they would make it to transplant or benefit from transplant.
So let's talk about your 71-year-old man.
So this is a 71-year-old male with chronic hepatitis B infection. This patient presented with actually abdominal pain and weight loss. He was not on surveillance despite having known hepatitis B. Noted to have elevated liver enzymes, AFP of 1,000. And the imaging showed a heterogeneously enhancing infiltrative mass measuring 6 centimeters with extension of the tumor. So this was tumor thrombosis into the right and left portal veins. This patient underwent a biopsy, and this is why I selected this case. So this patient, when you look at his imaging studies, he did not meet the established imaging criteria for diagnosis of hepatocellular carcinoma, did not have the typical arterial enhancement with venous or delayed phase washout.
Could I just ask you, though, I mean, in the face of a AFP over 1,000, though, I mean, what else could he have had?
He could have had a cholangiocarcinoma. So there are reports of other liver tumors leading to an elevated alpha-fetoprotein, especially in the setting of hepatitis. So hepatocellular carcinoma, even sometimes metastases to the liver. So AFP has been removed actually from the diagnostic criteria of hepatocellular carcinoma at this point.
Wow, interesting. So metastatic disease to the liver can cause that?
Right. I mean, we don't normally check that.
Right.
But yes, there are definitely reports of elevated alpha-fetoprotein in that setting.
Fascinating.
So biopsy showed poorly differentiated hepatocellular carcinoma. He had Chalpu-A cirrhosis. Now, this patient, we elected to treat him with first-line systemic therapy with sorafenib. The reason for that was that this patient had really BCLC stage C disease, had a large tumor with invasion of both the right and left portal vein, so unlikely to respond to locoregional modalities. So this was started in August 2013. By imaging in October 2013, the patient had significant increase in the size of the mass, now from 6 to 10 centimeters, and the alpha-fetoprotein went up to 25,000, along with worsening of the portal vein invasion. So this is a good example of definitive radiologic and clinical progression that led us to discontinue the sorafenib. So he was off therapy for a while. In December of 2013, he had enlarged abdominal lymph nodes. These met criteria as far as size and appearance, that they represented extrahepatic disease. So now has really extrahepatic documented disease, and then was placed on the clinical trial with nivolumab, and then achieved a partial response by February of 2014. And again, this is another reason I chose this case, to highlight that the objective responses with checkpoint inhibitors tend to occur most commonly within the first 3 months, the large majority of them. So this was a rapid radiologic response and clinical improvement as far as pain reduction, improvement in fatigue, etc. And the AFP decreased to below 100.
Wow.
The patient stayed on this therapy until September of 2014, when there was progression based on a new lymph node measuring 1.4 centimeter. At that point, this was the only site of progression. He's clinically doing well. So we kept going again, as is indicated with immunotherapy. He continued to be stable again until January of 2015, when there was again further increase in multiple lymph nodes. And at that point, his pain began to recur and discontinued treatment with nivolumab.
So then he was on treatment for, let me see, how long? You started December 2013?
Yes. So almost 13, 14 months.
And any tolerability issues that he had?
This patient actually had no tolerability issues whatsoever. I think as he passed the 8-9 month mark with nivolumab, he began to report a little bit more fatigue for a few days after the infusion. But that was really it.
What happened after that?
So after that, he went on another experimental therapy, phase one clinical trial.
Did he pass away?
No, this patient is still alive, actually.
Really?
Yes.
So January 2015, it's been 2 years since then.
Right. He went on to actually three different phase one trials after this. So naturally, this is a unique tumor because off therapy, it does certainly progress. It even causes symptoms. But then it's treatment sensitive. It does respond to treatments, either stabilizes or responds, and then progresses again. So it's certainly an outlier as far as how well this patient has done.
Do you think that, I mean, in terms of particularly these last couple years, looking back, do you think it's just the biology of his particular cancer, or do you think somehow the checkpoint inhibitors changed the biology of it?
That's a great question. This is an area that we're starting to explore. It does seem that checkpoint inhibitors may change the tumor microenvironment and the host environment for these tumors, and may alter how these patients respond to subsequent therapies or how their tumors behave even off therapy. I can tell you of some anecdotal experiences of patients who were removed from nivolumab for definitive progressive disease and who were off treatment, and I see them 6-8 months later with stable disease again and who are doing well. So this is something that we need to understand and invest more in understanding, but it's a great question now. There's a lot of hypotheses in this area.
I'm really surprised, because when I saw the write-up, I figured you just didn't put in the end, you know, that, you know, a lot of times that happens when people write up cases. Wow, that is really fascinating. Well, let's finish out hearing about your 68-year-old lady.
Yes. This is a 68-year-old female with no viral hepatitis. So this is metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, NASH-related liver disease.
Just out of curiosity, how obese was she?
Well, this is a lady who tells me, because at the time I saw her, she had lost some weight, etc., but had been, you know, even kind of visibly overweight for the majority of her life. Had high cholesterol, had hypertension, diabetes. So the whole metabolic syndrome type situation. And no decompensated cirrhosis. And again, the reason for this case selection is to highlight NASH as an emerging etiology for hepatocellular carcinoma. The other thing that we're starting to see, that NASH may not need to pass through the obligatory step of liver cirrhosis before leading to hepatocellular carcinoma. May not. So this lady had no varices, normal platelet count, so definitely Child-Pugh A.
Before you go on, any new theories about the pathophysiology of in terms of NASH and HCC, like what's going on?
No, I mean, again, the theory seems to be linked again to the chronic inflammation that results from NASH and the upregulation of multiple pre-oncogenic or oncogenic pathways as a result. So the patient had right upper quadrant pain, weight loss. She had two liver masses on ultrasound. Appropriately, this was evaluated outside our institution. A multi-phase CT scan was done showing two arterially enhancing lesions with washout. So she met the radiologic criteria for diagnosis. One measured 6.5 centimeters. The other one measured 4 centimeters. There were also two indeterminate 1 centimeter lesions. No evidence of metastatic disease. She was treated with TACE, so chemoembolization using doxorubicin beads. So this is a typical patient where there's no extrahepatic disease, there's no vascular invasion, only two definitive tumors, so it's certainly appropriate to evaluate chemoembolization. One thing I want to mention here related to chemoembolization is where do you draw the line? And what we know from the data related to chemoembolization is that the larger the tumors, the more multifocal the disease is, the higher the bilirubin, the lower the albumin, the less the chance of response from chemoembolization, even when it's liver-limited disease. So patient selection is important. After her first chemoembolization, the first scan showed unchanged size of both tumors. However, there was necrosis in up to 50% of the larger tumor that measured 6.5 centimeters. Based on this sign of response, she had another TACE, which targeted both lesions this time. The scan showed complete resolution of the enhancement in the 6.5 centimeter lesion, which now decreased in size to 3.8. The 4 centimeter lesion decreased to 2 centimeters, so cut by half, but still had residual enhancement. So at that point, we chose to go to radiofrequency ablation of this 2 centimeter lesion. And then the patient was observed for 14 months with no active disease. So very nice outcome here. Unfortunately, at that point, she developed evidence of a new liver lesion adjacent to the treated large mass, but this time with invasion into the main portal vein, which is an indication for systemic therapy. So she was started on sorafenib.
So what happened then once she got started on the sorafenib?
So the patient is actually still on sorafenib at this point. She's about 8 months into treatment with stable disease.
How has she tolerated therapy and how was it dosed?
Very good. The patient, when started sorafenib, had still Child-Pugh A cirrhosis and a bilirubin of 1.8. So we certainly gave the full standard dose of 400 milligrams BID twice daily. And during, I think, week 3 to 4, she had the hand-foot skin reaction, painful blisters, she couldn't walk. So we gave a treatment holiday for about 10 days, restarted at the reduced dose of 400 milligrams. And did more aggressive local therapy for her hands and feet. And she's been able to tolerate the 400 milligrams daily since then.
What are you thinking about in terms of her future therapy if she does develop disease progression? I guess it'll depend upon the circumstance, but theoretically, I guess you could think about not only regorafenib, but maybe a checkpoint inhibitor.
Absolutely. Both would be options in this situation. She, though, at this point, does fit the bill, so to speak, for a regorafenib candidate. She's been on sorafenib. She's tolerated the 400 milligram dose. And if we can prove radiologic progression, she'll be a good candidate for that as well.
Anything else that we haven't talked about today that you want to bring up? Any new strategies or things that you bring up in your talks that we haven't covered?
Maybe a couple of areas. One is the utilization of stereotactic body radiotherapy, SBRT. That's an emerging modality for the treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma. Ultimately, SBRT is another loco-regional modality. There's been many reports showing benefit as far as local control, as well as potentially control of vascular invasion with SBRT. So there's an ongoing international study, that's a U.S. intergroup study, that's led by Laura Dawson from Toronto, that's randomizing patients to treatment with sorafenib versus sorafenib plus SBRT. And this is an important approach, and hopefully we can all contribute to accrual to these types of studies to learn more about this new modality. Another thing as far as research that I'd like to emphasize is there seems to be an emerging role for epigenetic therapy. And briefly to cover that is in the setting of tumor development, there are genomic, but there are also epigenetic changes where certain methylation patterns and histone acetylation patterns are changed that lead to the silencing of tumor suppressor genes, etc. And epigenetic therapy using demethylating or hypomethylating agents like 5-azacitidine, decitabine, and some second-generation agents now is thought to reverse this suppression of the tumor suppressor genes and make them active again. Similarly with the HDAC inhibitors. There is some emerging data with these approaches, some studies have been done by us, by others, and now there are some plans for combining epigenetic therapy with either TKIs or with actually checkpoint inhibitors. We are launching studies like that because epigenetic therapy seems to also upregulate some of the immune-related pathways in the tumor.
And we're seeing that in MDS and AML, actually, checkpoint inhibitors plus hypomethylating agents.
Correct. These are ongoing as well. And then lastly is targeting the tumor-initiating cells, what we refer to as cancer stem cells as well. So there are ongoing studies with drugs that target the Wnt pathway or that target stem cells in various ways through STAT3, for example. And these are ongoing in combination with sorafenib. And this area of investigation, in my opinion, is very important because it may serve this molecular subtype that's Wnt-driven that's probably doesn't have an inflammatory component in the tumor and may not be well served by immunotherapy. So these are future-looking statements, I would say.
What about targeting MET?
So that's actually a great question we did not cover. So there are two ongoing efforts where MET is being targeted. One is with tivantinib, which was a selection trial in second-line therapy, where patients had to have c-MET expression in the tumor to be eligible, and they were randomized to tivantinib versus placebo. And we actually just also saw a press release from that saying that the study did not meet its primary endpoint. As you know, targeting MET did not also fare very well in other tumor types, at least in the GI field, in gastric cancer, for example. The other compound that may target MET as far as its spectrum is cabozantinib, which targets VEGFR2, but also the MET pathway. And that randomized phase 3 study in the second line setting, second or third line, is still ongoing. It hasn't read out yet.